If one builds the history of the universe from the bottom up, there is no reason the universe should end up with the internal space for the particle interactions that we actually observe, the Standard Model of elementary particle interactions. But in the top-down approach, we accept that universes exist with all possible internal spaces. In some universes, electrons have the weight of golf balls, and the force of gravity is stronger than that of magnetism. In ours, the Standard Model, with all its parameters, applies. One can calculate the probability amplitude for the internal space that leads to the Standard Model on the basis of the no boundary condition. As with the probability of there being a universe with three large space dimensions, it doesn't matter how small this amplitude is relative to other possibilities, because we already observed that the Standard Model describes our universe. The theory we describe in this chapter is testable. In the prior examples, we emphasized that the relative probability amplitudes for radically different universes, such as those with a different number of large space dimensions, don't matter. The relative probability amplitudes for neighboring, i.e. similar, universes, however, are important. The no-boundary condition implies that the probability amplitude is highest for histories in which the universe starts out completely smooth. The amplitude is reduced for universes that are more irregular. This means that the early universe would have been almost smooth, but with small irregularities. As we've noted, we can observe these irregularities as small variations in the microwaves coming from different directions in the sky. They have been found to agree exactly with the general demands of inflation theory. However, more precise measurements are needed to fully differentiate the top-down theory from others and to either support or refute it. These may well be carried out by satellites in the future. Hundreds of years ago, people thought the Earth was unique and situated at the center of the universe. Today, we know there are hundreds of billions of stars in our galaxy and hundreds of billions of galaxies, a large percentage of them with planetary systems. The results described in this chapter indicate that our universe itself is also one of many, and that its apparent laws are not uniquely determined. This must be disappointing for those who hoped that an ultimate theory, a theory of everything, would predict the nature of everyday physics. We cannot predict discrete features such as the number of large space dimensions or the internal space that determines the physical quantities we observe, e.g. the mass and charge of the electron and other elementary particles. Rather, we use those numbers to select which histories contribute to the Feynman sum. We seem to be at a critical point in the history of science, in which we must alter our conception of goals and of what makes a physical theory acceptable. It appears that the fundamental numbers and even the form of the apparent laws of nature are not demanded by logic or physical principle. The parameters are free to take on many values and the laws to take on any form that leads to a self-consistent mathematical theory. And they do take on different values and different forms in different universes. That may not satisfy our human desire to be special or to discover a neat package to contain all the laws of physics, but it does seem to be the way of nature. There seems to be a vast landscape of possible universes. However, as we'll see in the next chapter, universes in which life like us can exist are rare. We live in one in which life is possible, but if the universe were only slightly different, beings like us could not exist. What are we to make of this fine tuning? Is it evidence that the universe, after all, was designed by a benevolent creator? Or does science offer another explanation? Chapter 7: The Apparent Miracle. The Chinese tell of a time during the Xia Dynasty, circa 2205 to 1782 BC, when our cosmic environment suddenly changed. 10 suns appeared in the sky. The people on Earth suffered greatly from the heat, so the emperor ordered a famous archer to shoot down the extra suns. The archer was rewarded with a pill that had the power to make him immortal. but his wife stole it. For that offense, she was banished to the moon. The Chinese were right to think that a solar system with 10 suns is not friendly to human life. Today, we know that while perhaps offering great tanning opportunities, any solar system with multiple suns would probably never allow life to develop. The reasons are not quite as simple as the searing heat imagined in the Chinese legend. In fact, a planet could experience a pleasant temperature while orbiting multiple stars, at least for a while. But uniform heating over long periods of time, a situation that seems necessary for life, would be unlikely. To understand why, let's look at what happens in the simplest type of multiple star system, one with two suns, which is called a binary system. About half of all stars in the sky are members of such systems. But even simple binary systems can maintain only certain kinds of stable orbits. In each of these orbits, there would likely be a time in which the planet would be either too hot or too cold to sustain life. The situation is even worse for clusters having many stars. Our solar system has other lucky properties, without which sophisticated life forms might never have evolved. For example, Newton's laws allow for planetary orbits to be either circles or ellipses. Ellipses are squashed circles, wider along one axis and narrower along another. The degree to which an ellipse is squashed is described by what is called its eccentricity, a number between 0 and 1. An eccentricity near 0 means the figure resembles a circle, whereas an eccentricity near 1 means it is very flattened. Kepler was upset by the idea that planets don't move in perfect circles, but the Earth's orbit has an eccentricity of only about 2%, which means it is nearly circular. As it turns out, that is a stroke of very good fortune. Seasonal weather patterns on Earth are determined mainly by the tilt of the Earth's axis of rotation relative to the plane of its orbit around the Sun. During winter in the Northern Hemisphere, for example, the North Pole is tilted away from the Sun. The fact that the Earth is closest to the Sun at that time, only 91.5 million miles away, as opposed to around 94.5 million miles away from the Sun in early July, has a negligible effect on the temperature compared with the effect of its tilt. But on planets with a large orbital eccentricity, the varying distance from the Sun plays a much larger role. On Mercury, for example, with a 20% eccentricity, the temperature is over 200 degrees Fahrenheit warmer at the planet's closest approach to the Sun, perihelion, than when it is at its farthest from the Sun, aphelion. In fact, if the eccentricity of the Earth's orbit were near 1, our oceans would boil when we reached our nearest point to the Sun and freeze over when we reached our farthest, making neither winter nor summer vacations very pleasant. Large orbital eccentricities are not conducive to life, so we are fortunate to have a planet for which orbital eccentricity is near 0. We are also lucky in the relationship of our Sun's mass to our distance from it. That is because a star's mass determines the amount of energy it gives off. The largest stars have a mass about 100 times that of our Sun, while the smallest are about 100 times less massive. And yet, assuming the Earth-Sun distance as a given, if our Sun were just 20% less or more massive, the Earth would be colder than present-day Mars or hotter than present-day Venus. Traditionally, given any star, scientists define the habitable zone as the narrow region around the star in which temperatures are such that liquid water can exist. The habitable zone is sometimes called the Goldilocks zone, because the requirement that liquid water exist means that, like Goldilocks, the development of intelligent life requires that planetary temperatures be just right. The habitable zone in our solar system is tiny. Fortunately for those of us who are intelligent life forms, the Earth fell within it. Newton believed that our strangely habitable solar system did not arise out of chaos by the mere laws of nature. Instead, he maintained, the order in the universe was created by God at first and conserved by Him to this day in the same state and condition. It is easy to understand why one might think that. The many improbable occurrences that conspired to enable our existence and our world's human-friendly design would indeed be puzzling if ours were the only solar system in the universe. But in 1992 came the first confirmed observation of a planet orbiting a star other than our Sun. Today we know of hundreds of such planets, and few doubt that there exist countless others among the many billions of stars in our universe. That makes the coincidences of our planetary conditions, the single Sun, the lucky combination of Earth-Sun distance and solar mass, far less remarkable and far less compelling as evidence that the Earth was carefully designed just to please us human beings. Planets of all sorts exist. Some, or at least one, support life. Obviously, when the beings on a planet that supports life examine the world around them, they are bound to find that their environment satisfies the conditions they require to exist. It is possible to turn that last statement into a scientific principle. Our very existence imposes rules determining from where and at what time it is possible for us to observe the universe. That is, the fact of our being restricts the characteristics of the kind of environment in which we find ourselves. That principle is called the weak anthropic principle. We'll see shortly why the adjective weak is attached. A better term than anthropic principle would have been selection principle, because the principle refers to how our own knowledge of our existence imposes rules that select, out of all the possible environments, only those environments with the characteristics that allow life. Though it may sound like philosophy, the weak anthropic principle can be used to make scientific predictions. For example, how old is the universe? As we'll soon see, for us to exist, the universe must contain elements such as carbon, which are produced by cooking lighter elements inside stars. The carbon must then be scattered through space in a supernova explosion and eventually condense as part of a planet in a new generation solar system. In 1961, physicist Robert Dicke argued that the process takes about 10 billion years. So our being here means that the universe must be at least that old. On the other hand, the universe cannot be much older than 10 billion years, since in the far future all the fuel for stars will have been used up, and we require hot stars for our sustenance. Hence, the universe must be about 10 billion years old. That is not an extremely precise prediction, but it is true. According to current data, the Big Bang occurred about 13.7 billion years ago. As was the case with the age of the universe, anthropic predictions usually produce a range of values for a given physical parameter, rather than pinpointing it precisely. That's because our existence, while it might not require a particular value of some physical parameter, often is dependent on such parameters not varying too far from where we actually find them. We furthermore expect that the actual conditions in our world are typical within the anthropically allowed range. For example, if only modest orbital eccentricities, say between 0 and 0.5, will allow life, then an eccentricity of 0.1 should not surprise us, because among all the planets in the universe, a fair percentage probably have orbits with eccentricities that small. But if it turned out that the Earth moved in a near-perfect circle, with eccentricities, say, of 0.00000000001, that would make the Earth a very special planet indeed, and motivate us to try to explain why we find ourselves living in such an anomalous home. That idea is sometimes called the principle of mediocrity. The lucky coincidences pertaining to the shape of planetary orbits, the mass of the Sun, and so on, are called environmental because they arise from the serendipity of our surroundings and not from a fluke in the fundamental laws of nature. The age of the universe is also an environmental factor, since there are an earlier and a later time in the history of the universe, But we must live in this era because it is the only era conducive to life. Environmental coincidences are easy to understand because ours is only one cosmic habitat among many that exist in the universe, and we obviously must exist in a habitat that supports life. The weak anthropic principle is not very controversial, but there is a stronger form that we will argue for here, although it is regarded with disdain among some physicists. The strong anthropic principle suggests that the fact that we exist imposes constraints not just on our environment, but on the possible form and content of the laws of nature themselves. The idea arose because it is not only the peculiar characteristics of our solar system that seem oddly conducive to the development of human life, but also the characteristics of our entire universe, and that is much more difficult to explain. The tale of how the primordial universe of hydrogen, helium, and a bit of lithium evolved to a universe harboring at least one world with intelligent life like us is a tale of many chapters. As we mentioned earlier, the forces of nature had to be such that heavier elements, especially carbon, could be produced from the primordial elements and remain stable for at least billions of years. Those heavy elements were formed in the furnaces we call stars, so the forces first had to allow stars and galaxies to form. Those grew from the seeds of tiny inhomogeneities in the early universe, which was almost completely uniform, but thankfully contained density variations of about one part in 100,000. However, the existence of stars and the existence inside those stars of the elements we are made of is not enough. The dynamics of the stars had to be such that some would eventually explode and, moreover, explode precisely in a way that could disperse the heavier elements through space. In addition, the laws of nature had to dictate that those remnants could recondense into a new generation of stars, these surrounded by planets incorporating the newly formed heavy elements. Just as certain events on early Earth had to occur in order to allow us to develop, so too was each link of this chain necessary for our existence. But in the case of the events resulting in the evolution of the universe, such developments were governed by the balance of the fundamental forces of nature, and it is those whose interplay had to be just right in order for us to exist. One of the first to recognize that this might involve a good measure of serendipity was Fred Hoyle in the 1950s. Hoyle believed that all chemical elements had originally been formed from hydrogen, which he felt was the true primordial substance. Hydrogen has the simplest atomic nucleus, consisting of just one proton, either alone or in combination with one or two neutrons. Different forms of hydrogen, or any nucleus, having the same number of protons but different numbers of neutrons, are called isotopes. Today we know that helium and lithium, atoms whose nuclei contain two and three protons, were also primordially synthesized, in much smaller amounts, when the universe was about 200 seconds old. Life, on the other hand, depends on more complex elements. Carbon is the most important of these, the basis for all organic chemistry. Though one might imagine living organisms such as intelligent computers produced from other elements, such as silicon, it is doubtful that life could have spontaneously evolved in the absence of carbon. The reasons for that are technical, but have to do with the unique manner in which carbon bonds with other elements. Carbon dioxide, for example, is gaseous at room temperature and biologically very useful. Since silicon is the element directly below carbon on the periodic table, it has similar chemical properties. However, silicon dioxide, quartz, is far more useful in a rock collection than in an organism's lungs. Still, perhaps life forms could evolve that feast on silicon and rhythmically twirl their tails in pools of liquid ammonia. Even that type of exotic life could not evolve from just the primordial elements, for those elements can form only two stable compounds, lithium hydride, which is a colorless crystalline solid, and hydrogen gas, neither of them a compound likely to reproduce or even to fall in love. Also, the fact remains that we are a carbon life form, and that raises the issue of how carbon, whose nucleus contains 6 protons, and the other heavy elements in our bodies were created. The first step occurs when older stars start to accumulate helium, which is produced when 2 hydrogen nuclei collide and fuse with each other. This fusion is how stars create the energy that warms us. 2 helium atoms can in turn collide to form beryllium, an atom whose nucleus contains 4 protons. Once beryllium is formed, it could in principle fuse with a 3rd helium nucleus to form carbon. But that doesn't happen, because the isotope of beryllium that is formed decays almost immediately back into helium nuclei. The situation changes when a star starts to run out of hydrogen. When that happens, the star's core collapses until its central temperature rises to about 100 million degrees Kelvin. Under those conditions, nuclei encounter each other so often that some beryllium nuclei collide with a helium nucleus before they have had a chance to decay. Beryllium can then fuse with helium to form an isotope of carbon that is stable. But carbon is still a long way from forming ordered aggregates of chemical compounds of the type that can enjoy a glass of Bordeaux, juggle flaming bowling pins, or ask questions about the universe. For beings such as humans to exist, the carbon must be moved from inside the star to friendlier neighborhoods. That, as we've said, is accomplished when the star, at the end of its life cycle, explodes as a supernova, expelling carbon and other heavy elements that later condense into a planet. This process of carbon creation is called the triple alpha process, because alpha particle is another name for the nucleus of the isotope of helium involved, and because the process requires that 3 of them, eventually, fuse together. The usual physics predicts that the rate of carbon production via the triple alpha process ought to be quite small. Noting this, in 1952, Hoyle predicted that the sum of the energies of a beryllium nucleus and a helium nucleus must be almost exactly the energy of a certain quantum state of the isotope of carbon formed, a situation called a resonance, which greatly increases the rate of a nuclear reaction. At the time, no such energy level was known, but based on Hoyle's suggestion, William Fowler at Caltech sought and found it, providing important support for Hoyle's views on how complex nuclei were created. Hoyle wrote, "I do not believe that any scientist who examined the evidence would fail to draw the inference that the laws of nuclear physics have been deliberately designed with regard to the consequences they produce inside the stars. At the time, no one knew enough nuclear physics to understand the magnitude of the serendipity that resulted in these exact physical laws. But in investigating the validity of the strong anthropic principle, in recent years, physicists began asking themselves what the universe would have been like if the laws of nature were different. Today, we can create computer models that tell us how the rate of the triple alpha reaction depends upon the strength of the fundamental forces of nature. Such calculations show that a change of as little as 0.5% in the strength of the strong nuclear force, or 4% in the electric force, would destroy either nearly all carbon or all oxygen in every star, and hence the possibility of life as we know it. Change those rules of our universe just a bit, and the conditions for our existence disappear. By examining the model universes we generate when the theories of physics are altered in certain ways, one can study the effect of changes to physical law in a methodical manner. It turns out that it is not only the strengths of the strong nuclear force and the electromagnetic force that are made to order for our existence. Most of the fundamental constants in our theories appear fine-tuned in the sense that if they were altered by only modest amounts, the universe would be qualitatively different, and in many cases unsuitable for the development of life. For example, if the other nuclear force, the weak force, were much weaker, in the early universe all the hydrogen in the cosmos would have turned to helium, and hence there would be no normal stars. If it were much stronger, exploding supernovas would not eject their outer envelopes, and hence would fail to seed interstellar space with the heavy elements planets require to foster life. If protons were 0.2% heavier, they would decay into neutrons, destabilizing atoms. If the sum of the masses of the types of quark that make up a proton were changed by as little as 10%, there would be far fewer of the stable atomic nuclei of which we are made. In fact, the summed quark masses seem roughly optimized for the existence of the largest number of stable nuclei. If one assumes that a few hundred million years in stable orbit are necessary for planetary life to evolve, the number of space dimensions is also fixed by our existence. That is because, according to the laws of gravity, it is only in three dimensions that stable, elliptical orbits are possible. Circular orbits are possible in other dimensions, but those, as Newton feared, are unstable. In any but three dimensions, even a small disturbance, such as that produced by the pull of the other planets, would send a planet off its circular orbit and cause it to spiral either into or away from the Sun, so we would either burn up or freeze. Also, in more than three dimensions, the gravitational force between two bodies would decrease more rapidly than it does in three dimensions. In three dimensions, the gravitational force drops to one quarter of its value if one doubles the distance. In four dimensions, it would drop to 1/8. In five dimensions, it would drop to 1/16, and so on. As a result, in more than three dimensions, the Sun would not be able to exist in a stable state with its internal pressure balancing the pull of gravity. It would either fall apart or collapse to form a black hole, either of which could ruin your day. On the atomic scale, the electrical forces would behave in the same way as gravitational forces. That means the electrons in atoms would either escape or spiral into the nucleus. In neither case would atoms as we know them be possible. The emergence of the complex structures capable of supporting intelligent observers seems to be very fragile. The laws of nature form a system that is extremely fine-tuned, and very little in physical law can be altered without destroying the possibility of the development of life as we know it. Were it not for a series of startling coincidences in the precise details of physical law, it seems, humans and similar life forms would never have come into being. The most impressive fine-tuning coincidence involves the so-called cosmological constant in Einstein's equations of general relativity. As we've said, in 1915, when he formulated the theory, Einstein believed that the universe was static, that is, neither expanding nor contracting. Since all matter attracts other matter, he introduced into his theory a new anti-gravity force to combat the tendency of the universe to collapse onto itself. This force, unlike other forces, did not come from any particular source, but was built into the very fabric of space-time. The cosmological constant describes the strength of that force. When it was discovered that the universe was not static, Einstein eliminated the cosmological constant from his theory and called including it the greatest blunder of his life. But in 1998, observations of very distant supernovas revealed that the universe is expanding at an accelerating rate, an effect that is not possible without some kind of repulsive force acting throughout space. The cosmological constant was resurrected. Since we now know that its value is not zero, the question remains, why does it have the value that it does? Physicists have created arguments explaining how it might arise due to quantum mechanical effects, but the value they calculate is about 120 orders of magnitude, a 1 followed by 120 zeros, stronger than the actual value obtained through the supernova observations. That means that either the reasoning employed in the calculation was wrong, or else some other effect exists that miraculously cancels all but an unimaginably tiny fraction of the number calculated. The one thing that is certain is that if the value of the cosmological constant were much larger than it is, our universe would have blown itself apart before galaxies could form, and, once again, life as we know it would be impossible. What can we make of these coincidences? Luck in the precise form and nature of fundamental physical law is a different kind of luck from the luck we find in environmental factors. It cannot be so easily explained, and has far deeper physical and philosophical implications. Our universe and its laws appear to have a design that both is tailor-made to support us and, if we are to exist, leaves little room for alteration. That is not easily explained, and raises the natural question of why it is that way. Many people would like us to use these coincidences as evidence of the work of God. The idea that the universe was designed to accommodate mankind appears in theologies and mythologies dating from thousands of years ago, right up to the present. In the Mayan Popol Vuh mythohistorical narratives, the gods proclaim, "We shall receive neither glory nor honor from all that we have created and formed until human beings exist, endowed with sentience." A typical Egyptian text dated 2000 BC states, "Men, the cattle of God, have been well provided for. He, the sun god, made the sky and earth for their benefit." In China, the Taoist philosopher Lieyu Cao, circa 400 BC, expressed the idea through a character in a tale who says, "Heaven makes the five kinds of grain to grow and brings forth the finny and the feathered tribes, especially for our benefit." In Western culture, the Old Testament contains the idea of providential design in its story of creation, but the traditional Christian viewpoint was also greatly influenced by Aristotle, who believed in an intelligent natural world that functions according to some deliberate design. The medieval Christian theologian, Thomas Aquinas, employed Aristotle's ideas about the order in nature to argue for the existence of God. In the 18th century, another Christian theologian went so far as to say that rabbits have white tails in order that it be easy for us to shoot them. A more modern illustration of the Christian view was given a few years ago when Cardinal Christoph Schönborn, Archbishop of Vienna, wrote, "Now, at the beginning of the 21st century, faced with scientific claims like neo-Darwinism and the multiverse, many universes, hypothesis in cosmology, invented to avoid the overwhelming evidence for purpose and design found in modern science, the Catholic Church will again defend human nature by proclaiming that the immanent design in nature is real." In cosmology, the overwhelming evidence for purpose and design to which the cardinal was referring is the fine-tuning of physical law we described above. The turning point in the scientific rejection of a human-centered universe was the Copernican model of the solar system, in which the Earth no longer held a central position. Ironically, Copernicus's own worldview was anthropomorphic, even to the extent that he comforts us by pointing out that, despite his heliocentric model, the Earth is almost at the universe's center. Although the Earth is not at the center of the world, nevertheless the distance to that center is as nothing in particular when compared to that of the fixed stars. With the invention of the telescope, observations in the 17th century, such as the fact that ours is not the only planet orbited by a moon, lent weight to the principle that we hold no privileged position in the universe. In the ensuing centuries, the more we discovered about the universe, the more it seemed ours was probably just a garden-variety planet. But the discovery relatively recently of the extreme fine-tuning of so many of the laws of nature could lead at least some of us back to the old idea that this grand design is the work of some grand designer. In the United States, because the Constitution prohibits the teaching of religion in schools, that type of idea is called intelligent design, with the unstated but implied understanding that the designer is God. That is not the answer of modern science. We saw in Chapter 5 that our universe seems to be one of many, each with different laws. That multiverse idea is not a notion invented to account for the miracle of fine-tuning. It is a consequence of the no-boundary condition, as well as many other theories of modern cosmology. But if it is true, then the strong anthropic principle can be considered effectively equivalent to the weak one, putting the fine tunings of physical law on the same footing as the environmental factors, for it means that our cosmic habitat, now the entire observable universe, is only one of many, just as our solar system is one of many. That means that in the same way that the environmental coincidences of our solar system were rendered unremarkable by the realization that billions of such systems exist, the fine tunings in the laws of nature can be explained by the existence of multiple universes. Many people through the ages have attributed to God the beauty and complexity of nature that in their time seemed to have no scientific explanation. But just as Darwin and Wallace explained how the apparently miraculous design of living forms could appear without intervention by a supreme being, the multiverse concept can explain the fine-tuning of physical law without the need for a benevolent creator who made the universe for our benefit. Einstein once posed to his assistant, Ernst Strauss, the question, "Did God have any choice when he created the universe?" In the late 16th century, Kepler was convinced that God had created the universe according to some perfect mathematical principle. Newton showed that the same laws that apply in the heavens apply on Earth, and developed mathematical equations to express those laws that were so elegant they inspired almost religious fervor among many 18th century scientists, who seemed intent on using them to show that God was a mathematician. Ever since Newton, and especially since Einstein, the goal of physics has been to find simple mathematical principles of the kind Kepler envisioned, and with them to create a unified theory of everything that would account for every detail of the matter and forces we observe in nature. In the late 19th and early 20th century, Maxwell and Einstein united the theories of electricity, magnetism, and light. In the 1970s, the Standard Model was created, a single theory of the strong and weak nuclear forces and the electromagnetic force. String theory and M theory then came into being in an attempt to include the remaining force, gravity. The goal was to find not just a single theory that explains all the forces, but also one that explains the fundamental numbers we have been talking about, such as the strength of the forces and the masses and charges of the elementary particles. As Einstein put it, the hope was to be able to say that nature is so constituted that it is possible logically to lay down such strongly determined laws that within these laws only rationally, completely determined constants occur, not constants, therefore, whose numerical value could be changed without destroying the theory. A unique theory would be unlikely to have the fine tuning that allows us to exist. But if in light of recent advances we interpret Einstein's dream to be that of a unique theory that explains this and other universes with their whole spectrum of different laws, then M theory could be that theory. But is M theory unique or demanded by any simple logical principle? Can we answer the question, why M theory? Chapter 8, The Grand Design. In this book, we have described how regularities in the motion of astronomical bodies such as the Sun, the Moon, and the planets suggested that they were governed by fixed laws, rather than being subject to the arbitrary whims and caprices of gods and demons. At first, the existence of such laws became apparent only in astronomy, or astrology, which was regarded as much the same. The behavior of things on Earth is so complicated and subject to so many influences that early civilizations were unable to discern any clear patterns or laws governing these phenomena. Gradually, however, new laws were discovered in areas other than astronomy, and this led to the idea of scientific determinism. There must be a complete set of laws that, given the state of the universe at a specific time, would specify how the universe would develop from that time forward. These laws should hold everywhere and at all times, otherwise they wouldn't be laws. There could be no exceptions or miracles. Gods or demons couldn't intervene in the running of the universe. At the time that scientific determinism was first proposed, Newton's laws of motion and gravity were the only laws known. We have described how these laws were extended by Einstein in his general theory of relativity, and how other laws were discovered to govern other aspects of the universe. The laws of nature tell us how the universe behaves, but they don't answer the why questions that we posed at the start of this book. Why is there something rather than nothing? Why do we exist? Why this particular set of laws and not some other? Some would claim the answer to these questions is that there is a God who chose to create the universe that way. It is reasonable to ask who or what created the universe. But if the answer is God, then the question has merely been deflected to that of who created God. In this view, it is accepted that some entity exists that needs no creator, and that entity is called God. This is known as the first cause argument for the existence of God. We claim, however, that it is possible to answer these questions purely within the realm of science, and without invoking any divine beings. According to the idea of model-dependent realism introduced in Chapter 3, our brains interpret the input from our sensory organs by making a model of the outside world. We form mental concepts of our home, trees, other people, the electricity that flows from wall sockets, atoms, molecules, and other universes. These mental concepts are the only reality we can know. There is no model-independent test of reality. It follows that a well-constructed model creates a reality of its own. An example that can help us think about issues of reality and creation is the game of life, invented in 1970 by a young mathematician at Cambridge named John Conway. The word game in the game of life is a misleading term. There are no winners and losers. In fact, there are no players. The game of life is not really a game, but a set of laws that govern a two-dimensional universe. It is a deterministic universe. Once you set up a starting configuration or initial condition, the laws determine what happens in the future. The world Conway envisioned is a square array, like a chessboard, but extending infinitely in all directions. Each square can be in one of two states, alive or dead. Each square has eight neighbors, the up, down, left, and right neighbors, and four diagonal neighbors. Time in this world is not continuous, but moves forward in discrete steps. Given any arrangement of dead and live squares, the number of live neighbors determine what happens next according to the following laws. 1. A live square with two or three live neighbors survives. Survival. 2. A dead square with exactly three live neighbors becomes a live cell, birth. 3. In all other cases, a cell dies or remains dead. In the case that a live square has zero or one neighbor, it is said to die of loneliness. If it has more than three neighbors, it is said to die of overcrowding. That's all there is to it. Given any initial condition, these laws generate generation after generation. An isolated living square or two adjacent live squares die in the next generation because they don't have enough neighbors. Three live squares along a diagonal live a bit longer. After the first time step, the end squares die, leaving just the middle square, which dies in the following generation. Any diagonal line of squares evaporates in just this manner. But if three live squares are placed horizontally in a row, again, the center has two neighbors and survives while the two end squares die. But in this case, the cells just above and below the center cell experience a birth. The row therefore turns into a column. Similarly, the next generation, the column back turns into a row, and so forth. Such oscillating configurations are called blinkers. If three live squares are placed in the shape of an L, a new behavior occurs. In the next generation, the square cradled by the L will give birth. leading to a 2x2 block. The block belongs to a pattern type called the still life, because it will pass from generation to generation unaltered. Many types of patterns exist that morph in the early generations but soon turn into a still life or die, or return to their original form and then repeat the process. There are also patterns called gliders, which morph into other shapes and, after a few generations, return to their original form, but in a position one square down along the diagonal. If you watch these develop over time, they appear to crawl along the array. When these gliders collide, curious behaviors can occur, depending on each glider's shape at the moment of collision. What makes this universe interesting is that although the fundamental physics of this universe is simple, the chemistry can be complicated. That is, composite objects exist on different scales. At the smallest scale, the fundamental physics tells us that there are just live and dead squares. On a larger scale, there are gliders, blinkers, and still life blocks. At a still larger scale, there are even more complex objects, such as glider guns, stationary patterns that periodically give birth to new gliders that leave the nest and stream down the diagonal. If you observed the game of life universe for a while on any particular scale, you could deduce laws governing the objects on that scale. For example, on the scale of objects just a few squares across, you might have laws such as blocks never move, gliders move diagonally, and various laws for what happens when objects collide. You could create an entire physics on any level of composite objects. The laws would entail entities and concepts that have no place among the original laws. For example, there are no concepts such as collide or move in the original laws. Those describe merely the life and death of individual stationary squares. As in our universe, in the game of life, your reality depends on the model you employ. Conway and his students created this world because they wanted to know if a universe with fundamental rules as simple as the ones they defined could contain objects complex enough to replicate. In the game of life world, do composite objects exist that, after merely following the laws of that world for some generations, will spawn others of their kind? Not only were Conway and his students able to demonstrate that this is possible, but they even showed that such an object would be, in a sense, intelligent. What do we mean by that? To be precise, they showed that the huge conglomerations of squares that self-replicate are universal Turing machines. For our purposes, that means that for any calculation a computer in our physical world can in principle carry out, if the machine were fed the appropriate input, that is, supplied the appropriate game of life world environment, then, some generations later, the machine would be in a state from which an output could be read that would correspond to the result of that computer calculation. To get a taste for how that works, consider what happens when gliders are shot at a simple 2x2 block of live squares. If the gliders approach in just the right way, the block, which had been stationary, will move toward or away from the source of the gliders. In this way, the block can simulate a computer memory. In fact, all the basic functions of a modern computer, such as AND and OR gates, can also be created from gliders. In this manner, just as electrical signals are employed in a physical computer, streams of gliders can be employed to send and process information. In the game of life, as in our world, self-reproducing patterns are complex objects. One estimate, based on the earlier work of mathematician John von Neumann, places the minimum size of a self-replicating pattern in the game of life at 10 trillion squares, roughly the number of molecules in a single human cell. One can define living beings as complex systems of limited size that are stable and that reproduce themselves. The objects described above satisfy the reproduction condition but are probably not stable. A small disturbance from outside would probably wreck the delicate mechanism. However, it is easy to imagine that slightly more complicated laws would allow complex systems with all the attributes of life. Imagine an entity of that type, an object in a Conway-type world. Such an object would respond to environmental stimuli and hence appear to make decisions. Would such life be aware of itself? Would it be self-conscious? This is a question on which opinion is sharply divided. Some people claim that self-awareness is something unique to humans. It gives them free will, the ability to choose between different courses of action. How can one tell if a being has free will? If one encounters an alien, how can one tell if it is just a robot or it has a mind of its own? The behavior of a robot would be completely determined, unlike that of a being with free will. Thus, one could in principle detect a robot as a being whose actions can be predicted. As we said in Chapter 2, this may be impossibly difficult if the being is large and complex. We cannot even solve exactly the equations for three or more particles interacting with each other. Since an alien the size of a human would contain about 1,000 trillion trillion particles, even if the alien were a robot, it would be impossible to solve the equations and predict what it would do. We would therefore have to say that any complex being has free will, not as a fundamental feature, but as an effective theory, an admission of our inability to do the calculations that would enable us to predict its actions. The example of Conway's Game of Life shows that even a very simple set of laws can produce complex features similar to those of intelligent life. There must be many sets of laws with this property. What picks out the fundamental laws as opposed to the apparent laws that govern our universe? As in Conway's universe, the laws of our universe determine the evolution of the system, given the state at any one time. In Conway's world, we are the creators. We choose the initial state of the universe by specifying objects and their positions at the start of the game. In a physical universe, the counterparts of objects, such as gliders in the game of life, are isolated bodies of matter. Any set of laws that describes a continuous world such as our own will have a concept of energy, which is a conserved quantity, meaning it doesn't change in time. The energy of empty space will be a constant, independent of both time and position. One can subtract out this constant vacuum energy by measuring the energy of any volume of space relative to that of the same volume of empty space, so we may as well call the constant zero. One requirement any law of nature must satisfy is that it dictates that the energy of an isolated body surrounded by empty space is positive, which means that one has to do work to assemble the body. That's because if the energy of an isolated body were negative, it could be created in a state of motion so that its negative energy was exactly balanced by the positive energy due to its motion. If that were true, there would be no reason that bodies could not appear anywhere and everywhere. Empty space would therefore be unstable. But if it costs energy to create an isolated body, such instability cannot happen, because, as we've said, the energy of the universe must remain constant. That is what it takes to make the universe locally stable, to make it so that things don't just appear everywhere from nothing. If the total energy of the universe must always remain zero, and it costs energy to create a body, how can a whole universe be created from nothing? That is why there must be a law like gravity. Because gravity is attractive, gravitational energy is negative. One has to do work to separate a gravitationally bound system, such as the Earth and Moon. This negative energy can balance the positive energy needed to create matter, but it's not quite that simple. The negative gravitational energy of the Earth, for example, is less than a billionth of the positive energy of the matter particles the Earth is made of. A body such as a star will have more negative gravitational energy, and the smaller it is, the closer the different parts of it are to each other, the greater this negative gravitational energy will be. But before it can become greater than the positive energy of the matter, the star will collapse to a black hole, and black holes have positive energy. That's why empty space is stable. Bodies such as stars or black holes cannot just appear out of nothing, but a whole universe can. Because gravity shapes space and time, it allows space-time to be locally stable, but globally unstable. On the scale of the entire universe, the positive energy of the matter can be balanced by the negative gravitational energy, and so there is no restriction on the creation of whole universes. Because there is a law like gravity, the universe can and will create itself from nothing in the manner described in Chapter 6. Spontaneous creation is the reason there is something rather than nothing, why the universe exists, why we exist. It is not necessary to invoke God to light the blue touch paper and set the universe going. Why are the fundamental laws as we have described them? The ultimate theory must be consistent and must predict finite results for quantities that we can measure. We've seen that there must be a law like gravity, and we saw in Chapter 5 that for a theory of gravity to predict finite quantities, the theory must have what is called supersymmetry between the forces of nature and the matter on which they act. M theory is the most general supersymmetric theory of gravity. For these reasons, M theory is the only candidate for a complete theory of the universe. If it is finite, and this has yet to be proved, it will be a model of a universe that creates itself. We must be part of this universe because there is no other consistent model. M theory is the unified theory Einstein was hoping to find. The fact that we human beings, who are ourselves mere collections of fundamental particles of nature, have been able to come this close to an understanding of the laws governing us and our universe is a great triumph. But perhaps the true miracle is that abstract considerations of logic lead to a unique theory that predicts and describes a vast universe full of the amazing variety that we see. If the theory is confirmed by observation, it will be the successful conclusion of a search going back more than 3,000 years. We will have found the grand design. Glossary. Alternative histories, a formulation of quantum theory in which the probability of any observation is constructed from all the possible histories that could have led to that observation. Anthropic principle, the idea that we can draw conclusions about the apparent laws of physics based on the fact that we exist. Antimatter. Each particle of matter has a corresponding antiparticle. If they meet, they annihilate each other, leaving pure energy. Apparent laws. The laws of nature that we observe in our universe, the laws of the four forces, and the parameters, such as mass and charge, that characterize the elementary particles, in contrast to the more fundamental laws of M theory that allow for different universes with different laws. Asymptotic freedom, a property of the strong force that causes it to become weaker at short distances. Hence, although quarks are bound in nuclei by the strong force, they can move within nuclei almost as if they felt no force at all. Atom, the basic unit of ordinary matter, consisting of a nucleus with protons and neutrons surrounded by orbiting electrons. Baryon, a type of elementary particle such as the proton or neutron that is made of three quarks. Big Bang, the dense, hot beginning of the universe. The Big Bang theory postulates that about 13.7 billion years ago, the part of the universe we can see today was only a few millimeters across. Today, the universe is vastly larger and cooler, But we can observe the remnants of that early period in the cosmic microwave background radiation that permeates all space. Black hole, a region of space-time that, due to its immense gravitational force, is cut off from the rest of the universe. Boson, an elementary particle that carries force. Bottom-up approach. In cosmology, an idea that rests on the assumption that there's a single history of the universe with a well-defined starting point and that the state of the universe today is an evolution from that beginning. Classical physics. Any theory of physics in which the universe is assumed to have a single, well-defined history. Cosmological constant. A parameter in Einstein's equations that gives space-time an inherent tendency to expand. Electromagnetic force. The second strongest of the four forces of nature. It acts between particles with electric charges. Electron. An elementary particle of matter that has a negative charge and is responsible for the chemical properties of elements. Fermion. A matter-type elementary particle. Galaxy. A large system of stars, interstellar matter, and dark matter that is held together by gravity. Gravity. The weakest of the four forces of nature. It is the means by which objects that have mass attract each other. Heisenberg uncertainty principle. A law of quantum theory stating that certain pairs of physical properties cannot be known simultaneously to arbitrary precision. Meson, a type of elementary particle that is made of a quark and an antiquark. M-theory, a fundamental theory of physics that is a candidate for the theory of everything. Multiverse, a set of universes. Neutrino, an extremely light elementary particle that is affected only by the weak nuclear force and gravity. Neutron. A type of electrically neutral baryon that with the proton forms the nucleus of an atom. No boundary condition. The requirement that the histories of the universe are closed surfaces without a boundary. Phase. A position in the cycle of a wave. Photon. A boson that carries the electromagnetic force, a quantum particle of light. Probability amplitude. In a quantum theory, a complex number whose absolute value squared gives a probability. Proton. A type of positively charged baryon that with the neutron forms the nucleus of an atom. Quantum theory. A theory in which objects do not have single definite histories. Quark, an elementary particle with a fractional electric charge that feels the strong force. Protons and neutrons are each composed of three quarks. Renormalization, a mathematical technique designed to make sense of infinities that arise in quantum theories. Singularity, a point in space-time at which a physical quantity becomes infinite. Space-time, a mathematical space whose points must be specified by both space and time coordinates. String theory. A theory of physics in which particles are described as patterns of vibration that have length but no height or width, like infinitely thin pieces of string. Strong nuclear force. The strongest of the four forces of nature. This force holds the protons and neutrons inside the nucleus of an atom. It also holds together the protons and neutrons themselves, which is necessary because they are made of still tinier particles, quarks. Supergravity. A theory of gravity that has a kind of symmetry called supersymmetry. Supersymmetry. A subtle kind of symmetry that cannot be associated with a transformation of ordinary space. One of the important implications of supersymmetry is that force particles and matter particles, and hence force and matter, are really just two facets of the same thing. Top-down approach. The approach to cosmology in which one traces the histories of the universe from the top down, that is backward from the present time. weak nuclear force. One of the four forces of nature, the weak force is responsible for radioactivity and plays a vital role in the formation of the elements in stars and the early universe. This is Steve West. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Grand Design by Stephen Hawking and Leonard Mlodinow. This program was directed by Janet Stark. Executive producer, Janet Stark. Text copyright 2010 by Stephen Hawking and Leonard Mlodinow. Production copyright 2010, Random House, Inc. Published by arrangement with Random House Audio Publishing Group, a division of Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.